I'm Anthony Wright. I want to welcome you to a special interview with Dr. Michael Nagler, founder of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program at UC Berkeley. Dr. Nagler lives at the Blue Mountain Center of Meditation Ashram in Tamales. The headquarters are in Tamales. And he has written a book called The Search for a Nonviolent Future. And I'd like to welcome you, Michael.
Thank you very much, Anthony. Glad to be here.
And your book is a very pertinent topic for today's world. It's called The Search for a Nonviolent Future.
It's kind of a life's work for me. I've been a student of Gandhi's for decades, and I'm teaching a course in nonviolence at UC Berkeley since the mid-70s. And it's it's a focus, it's a preoccupation of mine. I have this very deep faith that unless we discover nonviolence and discover principled nonviolence in more or less the way that Mahatma Gandhi and others have developed it, we're pretty much goners. I mean, the earth is going up in flames. Even the planet is being destroyed indirectly by human violence right now. And I see nonviolence as the only answer. I also see a huge gap in general awareness of what nonviolence is, and we're starting to close that gap only very slowly. So I wrote the original version of this book when it was called Is There No Other Way? Mm-hmm. Came out in January of 2001, right before 9/11. I had even said something about the World Trade Towers episode of 93 in the book. It was a little bit scary. And then that was with a very small publisher in Berkeley called Berkeley Hills Books. And then I got the American Book Award, or rather the book did, in 2002. And it was picked up by Inner Ocean Publishing, based in Maui. And they've brought out this very, very pretty new edition, which I'm very happy with, and they are also. And the only change, Anthony, is that I've got a preface by Arun Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi's grandson.
Oh, my. Uh-huh. And we'd like to remind people that tomorrow, you had mentioned to me, was Chakra Jayanti.
That's right, Charka Jayanti.
Can you tell us what that is?
It means the spinning wheel's birthday. It was the name of the holiday that Mahatma Gandhi himself wanted it to bear. It's his birthday. October 2nd, 1869 is when he was born.
Mohandas Gandhi's birthday.
Isn't that
October
something?
Center.
Would he have been 135 tomorrow?
Can you speak about the heartfelt principle that Gandhi held so closely about satyagraha?
It's interesting that in January of 1908, he had to coin this new word, satyagraha, because in fact there was no word in the English language, no word current for what we today call nonviolence. In fact, the term nonviolence came into the English language in the mid-20s. So they were trying to call his thing passive resistance, which was leading to terrific misunderstandings. First of all, it's far from passive. It's extremely active. It's proactive. Most of the time when you're doing satyagraha, you're calling the shots and you're planning the strategies and you're maneuvering your opponent into a favorable confrontation.
There's incredible power in this, and I think it's really important for our listeners to understand just how powerful a personal choice like this can be.
Well, Gandhi called it the greatest power that humankind had been endowed with, and this is why I'm devoting my life to it. I think he was absolutely right. The trouble is we haven't understood it. Now, there is an interesting question where exactly the power comes from. And I've got a theory that it comes from the conversion of negative drives that are coming up in our consciousness. And the negative drives are kind of the classic three from the wisdom tradition everywhere, which are anger, fear, and greed. And when you have an impulse answering to one of those drives coming up in your mind, that's giving you a whole bunch of available energy. So the question is what to do with it. If you just act it out, you're being violent. If you suppress it, you're being violent to yourself. But it turns out that we human beings have another choice, and that is to convert it. We convert it into creative, positive, loving action. towards the other person.
But it does have to be a deliberate choice to do so. So the first step is to recognize that that energy coming up in oneself.
I totally would agree with that. It's to recognize it as energy coming up.
Yes.
Not as a command that you must lash out.
Right.
You must grab. You must run away. So you're stepping back just a hair.
And for a moment, to make a choice.
Exactly.
But it's the choice of each person, is it not?
It rests totally on the choice of each person. Uh-huh. That's why I've coined the term person power for nonviolence, mm-hmm. because people have been using a term people power, meaning the power of an aroused population against the government, and the classic people power revolution is the expulsion of President Marcos from the Philippines.
Oh, yes.
And with many, many other examples.
Right.
But I maintain that if you're really talking about satyagraha in the sense that Gandhi meant it, you're talking about individual choices. And I was very interested to note that Cardinal Jaime Sin, who was a major proponent of the People's Power Revolution, he made a point. I think he made this statement in 1976. It was a miracle, 2 million people taking to the streets because of an individual decision that each one of them made.
Yes.
You see what I'm driving at?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I wanted to come back, though, to the idea of anger, fear, and greed that, in a conversation just before our broadcast, I was talking with one of the people in the office, and they said, we feel like anger can sometimes be a productive force or productive energy, but you're speaking about converting this.
Yes, I would say that anger can always be a productive creative energy. It always has that potential, but not if we kick back and do nothing and let it ride roughshod over us.
Because as I remember, Gandhi was tremendously angry in being thrown off the train in South Africa the first time.
That was, he himself called it a titanic rage that he had. And mm-hmm. Even in Attenborough's film, there's one moment where you can sort of see this anger flitting across his face. And I wish they had actually made more of it, mm-hmm. because you have to realize that's where he started from. Because
that was the moment he made the personal choice.
And not only did he make it in that moment, but somehow, through the grace of God, he recognized that that was a choice that he could make always. And then comes the really big thing, Anthony. That is when he decided that he has to systematically program himself to make that choice.
So it's to make a choice about the internal feeling within each person, mm-hmm. to choose to shift that momentum out of necessarily a cultural momentum that you have.
Amen. Yeah.
And one of the things I wanted to mention is, in today's culture, there seems to be lots of fear.
Wow.
That is being offered for involvement with. There's a lot of momentum, and. I am making a personal choice, actually on a moment-to-moment basis and a daily basis, that I am going to other than participate in people's fear, because I want to be able to make a heartfelt decision with other people, with other groups of people. I want that to come from my heart rather than my limbic system.
That's a very sound choice. It will lead to a healthier life for us individually, mm-hmm. when we make that choice, and it'll lead to much greater independence of judgment in the political world, and it'll eventually lead us, I think, into a leadership, a position where we'll be able to help turn the world around. You know, I was talking at Stanford a few weeks ago with some wonderful people, Arun Gandhi among them, and Frances Moore LePay, and Frankie said she had just gotten on a plane just gotten into a taxi in Boston and asked the taxi driver, who was obviously from Russia, what he thought of us here in the U.S. And he said, "You people are all afraid. You don't trust each other." And then she comes out to San Francisco, gets in a cab, driver is Pakistani or something. "What do you think of us here in the U.S.?" "Guess what? You people are all afraid of each other." So I think we're talking about this in two steps. The first step is the recognition that we have a choice.
Yes.
When a powerful emotion comes up, we are not marionettes, you know. It does not jerk the strings, regardless of what we're told in our popular culture.
And certainly there's intensity there, but we can choose to what to do with that intensity.
Exactly. And in part of my book, in fact, is experiences of individuals, psychological experiments, and social actions, which are based precisely on what to do with that intense emotion that's coming up. And as I say, that's step number one. Step number two, and this is actually just getting clear in my mind as we're talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Step number two is recognizing that you have to prepare yourself always. That is, if you wait until the provocative situation comes up and you hope that you're going to have the detachment and the strength of character to make that choice, you're not very, very likely to succeed all the time. So this is why Gandhi founded these ashrams, or spiritual communities. He founded four of them, two in South Africa, two in India. And this was to train people 24/7 to be psychologically disposed to deal with that energy as it came up.
So it's about practicing.
Practicing is right. Absolutely what it's about.
Yeah. We're talking with Dr. Michael Nagler. I'm Anthony Wright, and Dr. Nagler is the founder of the Peace and Conflict Studies program at UC Berkeley. He lives at the Blue Mountain Meditation Center in Tomales. In the first chapter of your book, you talk about that we're right on the verge of a transition right now, and we have a choice. Not only personally, what we've been talking about in the last few minutes, but collectively as a culture. Can you elaborate on that more, please?
I can sure try, Anthony. You know, I am I do not have a good track record on predicting the future, so I don't know which way the choice will go.
Well, and it's about national security, though, too, but personal security.
Yeah. Just last week, I gave a talk in a military affairs class at Berkeley on national security, trying to point out to them that they're looking at a very, very narrow spectrum of what they think security will come from. And it's all based on the predisposition toward violence. And, you know, given that we have to use violence, how much security are you going to get?
Because violence always begets more violence.
Yeah, this is, in fact, if I had to pull out one discovery, one formula from my book, I'll give it to you in the language that I have it in the book and then in a slightly revised version. Mm-hmm. But I was coming off a statement made by a friend of mine in Santa Cruz who said that people try nonviolence for a week, and when it doesn't, quote, work, unquote, they go back to violence, which hasn't worked for centuries. So I said, what Ted Rozhak is talking about here is two different concepts of what we mean by work. If we mean, right. You see what I'm driving at? Yeah. If we mean I get you to do what I want right now, mm-hmm. That's quote work, unquote. But if we mean have a good effect on the whole environment, that's real work, and that's without quotes. So my famous formula, if I may, is violence sometimes, quote, works. There's no question about that. You know, you go rob a store, you pull out a gun, you get your money.
Yes.
But never works. It never leads to a more secure environment.
I remember Gandhi lying on his bed of some many days in the Attenborough film, looking up at his attendant saying, think of it, nonviolence has always worked, and all tyrannies have passed away.
Yeah.
Just think of it. Everyone passed away through history.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary.
And the only reason that we don't see it is that we're trained to focus on the AB, you know, the stimulus response, and not to look down the road to the future.
Mm-hmm.
If we did that, we would see that, as I say, violence sometimes, quote, works, but never works, and nonviolence sometimes works and always works.
Well, and the cause, and I keep coming back to this idea that I've heard from all the way from quantum physicists to philosophers like Alan Watts, that the cause and the effect are the same.
You know, it's so funny you should mention that, Anthony, because just yesterday in my class I had sort of a breakthrough, because I spend a week talking about quantum theory and new physics before I launch into nonviolence, and I discuss it a little bit in the book. And I'm always looking for where they really kind of intersect. And it dawned on me that they intersect around this very point. Nonviolence is that approach to conflict which says the ends and the means cannot be segregated. I can never, never bring about a positive result by using negative means.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I can bomb Iraq until the cows come home, and guess what? There won't be an America-loving democracy at the end. But nonviolence says that the ends and the means, in other words, in physical terms, the cause and the effect, are interconvertible. It has something to do with what happens with time at the remote verges of the observable world.
Right, right. And that there is actually only this moment. And when, to speak, because one of the questions that our potential co-host Mimi Calpestri asked was about five things that each of us can do for peace. Well, one of the things that I am going to choose in myself, number one, I'm going to be other than fearful. And the second thing is that I'm going to attend to the intensity in my own awareness, and I'm going to make another choice to be at harmony with the universe in my own body to begin with. And I wanted to ask you what your thought was about how can we infect one another with this momentum. Because I think an old Chinese proverb says, if you would change the world, you must change the state. If you would change the state, you must change the family. If you would change the family, you must change yourself.
That's person power. That's what we were talking about. I would go so far as to say we cannot help affecting one another. We're affecting one another with our state of consciousness that we're in now. When we change our state of consciousness, we'll be affecting one another differently. And that's what brought me to meditation, was that realization. And meditation, in turn, brings me to this tremendous hope that we can, there's a whole other dimension that we can develop, which can enable us to introduce this positive energy into the world. Now, I think what Mimi was trying to get me to talk about was what's new in the new edition of the book.
Okay.
Is a 5-point program that I have at the back for what everybody can do. It's pretty similar to what you were saying, but here's how it goes. The first one, and this is going to hit, this is not my most popular suggestion that I ever make, but here it goes. I cannot tell you how much damage the commercial mass media have done. And if you want to clear up the negativity, the junk, the greed, the selfishness, and the desertion of truth that's going on in all our minds, I think, and I say this repeatedly in the book, the first and most important and probably most powerful step is to distance yourself from the commercial mass media. And that's an easy thing to do today because we get, there are stations like this one all over the world and even smaller, and we can get news from the internet, which, you know, I have much, much better news feeds than I do through the commercial sources. And for entertainment, I made the radical suggestion of hanging out with your friends. Go down to the Point Reyes Light Cafe with a bunch of folks, and it'll be a lot more entertaining than seeing a good movie. So that's step number one. Step number two, I encourage people, strange as it may sound for a person to say this in a public context and over the airwaves, but I do encourage people to look for a spiritual practice that will help them reinforce precisely the three choices that you were just talking about. And then thirdly, act out the new consciousness that you'll get from these two disciplines. You're going to be, if you're not exposing your mind to the commercial world, or as little as you possibly can, and you are, on the other hand, practicing some sort of discipline that's enabling yourself to get these negative energies converted in the way that we were saying, you're going to be potentially kinder, wiser, and happier. And I recommend that people interact more on a much more personal basis. One of the keys to violence, and this is an important word that I use in the book that comes up in my course and helps people a lot to understand where violence is coming from, that word is dehumanization.
Oh, yes.
And so if we stick with each other humanly and share this good energy that we're generating,
right,
that's a powerful step.
To say that you are not a thing. You are a human with me. We are part of one being.
If we would all say that, there'd be no more violence on this planet.
Well, how can I be angry at my right hand or my left hand? It's a right. part of my body.
Right. And in non-body terms, we are all, you know, part of a single force field that we want to call...
A single beingness.
A beingness, a consciousness, whatever we want to call it. And when we foul mm-hmm. that nest of consciousness with our anger, we hurt ourselves first and others second. St. Augustine said, imagine people thinking that their enemy could do them more damage than their enmity. Isn't that wonderful?
And yet there is a point about where the enemy is, you know, Jesus said to love your enemy, but I think it's also to love the enemy for the definition that it gives to oneself. To say, okay, my right hand is different from my left hand, but they're not necessarily enemies, but they're being able to define. And if I want to find a way to define something, it may be more useful to understand that I'm defining a part of myself that I'm other than familiar with.
Ultimately, anything that we can observe is really a part of our larger self. And shrinking into this smaller self that the commercial world wants us to inhabit is the only thing that makes us lose sight of that. So,
and your fourth point then?
My fourth point is to learn about nonviolence, and you know that's kind of where my life's work comes in. It's a very, I think you could say, elegant, beautiful, articulate science. And if people think that they know everything they need to know about nonviolence just because they've been on a demonstration or something, I have good news for them. There's a lot more to learn about it. And it can be used accurately or inaccurately, just like anything else. And then, finally, when you've done all of that, which is a lot, then pick out a wonderful peace project and get to work. And I think that our efforts will be A, much more effective, and B, much more harmonic, much more coherent, if we give them that four-point background.
Well, thank you so much for that. We're speaking, this is Anthony Wright, and we're talking with Dr. Michael Nagler, founder of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program at UC Berkeley. And I'm Anthony Wright, and we're speaking with Dr. Michael Nagler, founder of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program at UC Berkeley. He has republished a new book called The Search for a Nonviolent Future. During the break, you were speaking about that there were some classic misconceptions about nonviolence, that it doesn't mean simply appeasement, doesn't mean just lying down. I remember in the Attenborough Forum about Gandhi, him standing up in the Indian Congress about the law that allowed the South African police to come into their the East Indians' homes, and he said, we will choose to not obey this law. You may beat me, you may even kill me, but you will have then my dead body and not my obedience.
Beautiful scene.
Incredible. So can you speak about the classic misconceptions about nonviolence?
Yes, it all seems to arise from looking upon violence as a positive thing and nonviolence as an absence of that positive thing. Whereas, in fact, it's exactly the other way around.
I want to stop you there. It's a very curious thing, and Mimi said had a question in here about Penelope's male hand and the violence in the Odyssey. Is that something that humans have as a natural cultural momentum and inheritance? But maybe this goes back to the point about it's a natural arising thing from any human, and that we have a choice to make. How do we choose differently?
Well, it's according to Gandhi and many, many others, it's being human that gives us that choice. In other words, our natural endowment is to have the capacity for violence, but also the capacity to convert it. And that's what differentiates mm-hmm. us from other kinds of beings on this planet. But for some reason, we tend to think of violence as real and nonviolence as its absence. And I spend the whole first chapter trying to lay that one to rest. And when you have that misconception, you think that nonviolence means not being violent, whereas that's only a byproduct. Nonviolence means actively, creatively seeking the best interests of yourself and your opponent. It means having the faith that there is such a best interest for both of you, and it means courageously moving yourself and your opponent toward that common goal, toward that best interest. And 9 times out of 10, it's the nonviolent person, if they know what they're doing, mm-hmm. who's really being proactive. If you watch Gandhi, he has these climactic confrontations at just about at 10-year intervals in the 20s and the mm-hmm. 30s and the 40s. And he spends 10 years building up his own community on the one hand and maneuvering his opponent into a confrontation on the other hand.
Yeah.
And that, you know, when that happens after 10 years of his patient work, very, very active, very proactive, very controlling, really, what you get is what we call in the field today the nonviolent moment.
And I remember flashing in my mind right now are the films of the police using fire hoses on the demonstrators during the civil rights demonstrations.
Right.
And those people just, they were going to walk across that bridge.
Yes.
They were going to do it. Again, an Attenborough film about these queues of 4 or 5 or 10 abreast of the workers lining up to be clubbed by the South African policemen.
Those workers were actually on a march.
Oh, they were. Okay.
Yeah, in historical reality, they walked off the job in Natal province, and Gandhi was leading them across the river into the Transvaal, which was illegal. And they were confronted by police who used cavalry charges, beat them, and also firing. They also shot. And these people did not aggressively defend themselves.
But they didn't run either.
They did not run, and they did not strike back. They took what they had to take. This was a nonviolent moment, and that was, I think, the scene that told Gandhi that he could make this work in India.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the scene that you see in Attenborough's film, the Dharasana salt pan raid, that's exactly what they did. 20 at a time, they walked into this police brutality all day long. Now, of course, nobody wants that to happen, and that's why I was emphasizing that most of the time, you don't have to do that. If you can build, if you can start earlier in the conflict, and build up your own side and clarify your goals and make it very clear that you will not accept anything else, but that you don't lack in respect for your opponent.
Because in a way, one's own side is inclusive of the opponent, is it not?
Well, that would be the difference between the way a nonviolent person views the conflict and the way the opponent does. I remember that wonderful moment in Martin Luther King's history in the bus boycott.
Mm-hmm.
In Montgomery, Alabama, when they almost had the White Citizens Council agreeing that the blacks could sit wherever they wanted to in the public buses. And one fellow piped up and said, "Oh, I just realized if we do this, then the Negroes will think that they have won, and that we cannot allow."
But that wasn't King's approach at all.
And this is why I say, see, as a nonviolent person, you're mm-hmm, seeing mm-hmm. The inclusivity, you're seeing the harmony, you're seeing, as it were, the win-win solution.
I can't remember who it was who said, "We need to free our white brothers."
That was Martin Luther King. And since that's what makes your side eventually is going to prevail, that's what I mean by...
Because it is all-inclusive.
Exactly.
Right.
In fact, Toynbee said a wonderful thing about Gandhi in India. He said, "He made it impossible for us to go on ruling India, but he made it possible for us to abdicate without rancor and without dishonor.
And with great dignity, because he held the opponent with great dignity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very critical point in conflict that goes on within inside oneself, in conflict that goes on between oneself and another person, mm-hmm. or between groups of people. Mm-hmm. The dignity is critical to recognize that underlying unity, even though I may not have a clue how another person comes to think that what they are doing is going to be positive. I'm going to meet them with an assumption of that unity.
And the fact that they are human beings just as we are, regardless of what they have done or right. are planning to do to us. And, you know, Anthony, you mentioned a moment ago this appeasement thing, and that made me think wherever I speak, and this is pretty close to home for me. I've been giving talks in Europe and all over the U.S.
Welcome home.
Yeah, thank you. Feels good in this town. I really like it here.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that regardless of what kind of audience I'm speaking to, whether it be the military students that I was talking to on campus this week, or whether it be peace activists in Germany, the question always comes up, this would not have worked against Hitler.
I was going to ask you about, there was a section in your book about mm-hmm. the Rosenstrasse demonstration and where people took to the streets. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, you bet. The first thing to realize is that Hitler was a problem that was not addressed for about 20 years, and that's why it got so monstrously out of proportion.
He actually worked with a lot of people's fears, saying that if you ought to be fearful of X, mm-hmm. and if you go with what I say, I will control X and be able to keep X at bay or defeat X. Is that correct?
Gosh, it's not only correct, but it sounds sort of familiar. I wonder where I've heard this recently.
Well,
in fact, there are subtler connections there, which I think we maybe shouldn't go into right now. But the fact is that Hitler did not spring into existence by himself.
Right.
He was supported by forces all over the world. He played to people's fears in exactly the way that you're describing.
Mm-hmm.
He created a reign of terror, and people, you know, did not have the insight, the wisdom, the courage to step out of it. And so the situation got very, very bad.
Well, they chose to go with their own most visceral limbic response.
Yeah, and it's a choice that we're conditioned to do, and our culture is conditioning it more and more.
Right.
But when the showdown came on February 28th, I believe, of 1943, Hitler, the Gestapo, arrested all of the remaining Jews in Berlin. And they were remaining because they were what were called Mischlinge in German slang. They were mixed race people. They were married to Aryans. And to everyone's surprise, the wives and the mothers of these men started to congregate around the detention center instead of taking it quietly. And by the end of the weekend, defying repeated orders by the Gestapo to break up and go home, you had about 6,000 women who said, "Give us back our men, we're not going away." And this created a tremendous crisis for the regime. Hitler refused to make a decision, handed it over. Interesting.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, he refused. Handed it over to Göring, who at the end of the weekend caved in, if you please. The Gestapo blinked, and they handed back all these men. And even people like me, who have been following this, did not realize until a few years ago that every single one of those men survived the war. Not only that, people in Netherlands, people in Barcelona, people in Paris, all over Europe, they had Jewish men who were married to non-Jewish wives, and the occupiers didn't know what to do with them, so they were looking to Berlin for a precedent. So you have this incredible situation where a few thousand women, totally untrained, not even knowing the name of what they were doing, no way to organize it, no way to continue it, they basically saved tens of thousands of people. So we can say, this is a historical truth, when nonviolence was tried against Hitler, it succeeded brilliantly.
When it had the depth of conviction of those who were actively participating.
Well, I imagine if you didn't have the depth of conviction, you wouldn't even try nonviolence in that situation.
Well, there has to be a willingness to face death.
Right. And the sad fact of the matter is that most of those people died anyway. Mm-hmm. So their choice was not between living and dying, alas. It was between dying in a meaningful way, in an effective way, and dying as a helpless victim.
Yes. I'm Anthony Wright, and we're talking with Dr. Michael Nagler, founder of the Peace and Conflict Studies program at UC Berkeley. Dr. Nagler lives at Blue Mountain Center of Meditation in Tamales, and he's written a book called The Search for Nonviolent Future. So you spoke about, again, the conversion of anger, fear, and greed, and that's an individual choice. But I wonder if you can speak a bit more about that, because you have a chapter in your book called The Way Out of Hell.
Yes. After you learn that you have such a choice and get into the habit of making it and find a disciplined way of making it regularly, the next obvious step we want to ask ourselves is, how can we institutionalize it? Because you look around you and you see that almost all the institutions that we've built in this culture of ours, in our society, are based on the threat of harmful force as an ultimate sanction. You know, and I choose...
Do what I say or I'll kill you.
Yeah, or I'll do what you don't... Do what I want or I'll do something that you don't want, is the classic definition.
And so that's a threat.
It's a threat. It's called threat power. Whereas nonviolence comes from what we call integrative power, which can be paraphrased, I'm going to do something authentic and we're going to end up seeing a common good. We're going to end up closer.
And if you want to threaten me, that's certainly your choice, but I'm going to choose how I'm going to respond to your threat in saying that you are a part of me.
Which means that if you threaten me with punishment, I will refuse to be coerced. And so the example that I pick in the book is how we can build that into a classic institution, and I chose criminal justice, how we could change from retributive to restorative justice. First of all, that all parties respect one another as human beings and realize that even when someone does something that we consider absolutely unacceptable and beyond the bounds of human intercourse, that they're still human beings and they are probably victims of the situation that they're caught in. And when we give them that human respect, we can show them with our very attitude, that's half the battle, we've shown them a way out. But then it behooves every one of us, I think, to ask, how did we get into this situation? How did we, as a society, let things so deteriorate by the time of, let's say, the Seattle protests, that we become, I'm going to use harsh language here, we've become a nation of torturers. I mean, those scenes that you see of policemen deliberately swabbing pepper spray into the eyes of students, what is this? How have we let this happen to us? And the point of my book...
You mean as a culture?
As a culture.
Yes. Well, and also as individuals, how did people choose to be in that place at that time? Both law enforcement and the protesters.
Yeah, but in many cases, the law enforcement people, this wasn't what they bought into. When they joined law enforcement, they saw it and were trained to see it as something much more positive and much more humane. But then as a culture, we moved to more and more alienation from one another, and more infliction of force as a means of getting things done. And why is that? One of my answers is, I'll give you two answers. One is pursue our own private gratification. And two, we simply do not know of an alternative. We do not know. You stop the average person on the street, they would not be able to explain to you how you could build a system of trust and compliance and a rule of law without the use of threat.
Mm-hmm. So I'm also familiar with the phenomenon of desensitization mm-hmm. among not only law enforcement, yeah. but even hospital personnel.
Yeah, well, I...
Over time, that people in those service capacities get to seeing the people that they work with mm-hmm. and for as objects.
Yeah, and that is...
And they lose that humanization.
I think that's the biggest human failure. I just think that human beings should never, never let that happen. And where I see a lot of it happening, I hope I'm not just constantly thwanging on the same string here, but in the culture of commercials, where people are encouraged to be hysterically excited about things that don't matter, like saving a few bucks here and having a taste sensation there, and all of that attention.
My shirt makes me better than you.
Yeah.
Or because I have a new couch, mm-hmm. or a new car, or mm-hmm. it's product based.
Yeah, and because I have that object, I'm happy. All of that attention is stolen from where it belongs, which is our awareness of one another as members of a single human community. In terms of dealing with the conflict itself, there are people who know how to do this. I'll be having dinner with Marshall Rosenberg down in Berkeley in a couple of weeks. He's the founder of Nonviolent Communication. And there are many, many mediation groups which specialize in getting people who have kind of been polarized by a conflict and are seeing things from incompatible points of view, getting them back on the table, getting them to accept one another as human beings and moving forward together. Then in terms of the larger question that I think the way to do this is through study and through self-reflection. You know, there are books, I hesitate to mention it, but my own book does deal with this, The Search for a Nonviolent Future. And we have a study guide for the book that's on my website, which is metacenter.org, metacenter.org. And there are groups all around the country, because the book is not a light, easy read. It's a pretty dense thing. It took me years to write it. And there are people all over the country who are reading the book and getting together in study groups and just discussing this. And once we've identified what it is that is distancing ourselves from one another and from our own humanity, avoid those things and go for the antidote.
We're speaking with Dr. Michael Nagler, who is a founder of the Peace and Conflict Series Studies Program at UC Berkeley. I wonder if you could speak about the last chapter in your book, about the metaphysics of peace.
The metaphysics of compassion is what I called it. That has been the most problematic chapter, the most problematic part of the book, because in the rest of the book, I think I was, well, I wouldn't say not coming from a place of heart, but using my head. And in this chapter, I just sort of let it all hang out and talk about compassion and, you know, reestablishing our awareness of one another and expanding our human horizons. The reason I call it the metaphysics of compassion is because of an idea that struck me very forcibly many years ago when I was just starting peace and conflict studies at Berkeley. My teacher at the Blue Mountain Center had been talking about this idea for years, but he hadn't named it, and a colleague of mine came up with the name. And the name is Unity in Diversity. And you were reflecting that a while ago, Anthony, when you said that, you know, my right hand is different from my left hand, but that doesn't mean that they have to compete. That once you start...
Well, they do different things.
They do different things, and they help each other.
As a complement, it's like two poles of the same magnet. Yeah. How is it possible for me to get angry at one hand, or even a finger of one hand, for making an error? Well, where it was just doing what it did. Mm-hmm. I need to understand maybe how to move my hand, my other hand, maybe a little differently, or how to invite it to move differently.
Yeah, and I don't know who it was that said this anymore, but I think it may have been my friend Gene Knudsen Hoffman down in Santa Barbara. An enemy is someone whose story you have not yet heard. And when you hear somebody's story, you see how they mm-hmm. and their aspirations fit into the whole picture. And then you come to actually welcome and celebrate the differences. This is, I think a lot of our activism today is generated either from diversity by itself or from unity by itself. And we in the progressive movement tend to go for the diversity, and people in the non-progressive world tend to go for the unity. And what we need to do is get together and realize that the unity underlies the diversity. Unity cannot exist without the diversity, and diversity cannot be diversity without the underlying unity.
E pluribus unum.
Exactly, and it's got to come off that dollar bill and into our hearts and minds.
And if we all, if we don't hang together, we will surely all hang separately.
But it's a question now of recognizing where that togetherness has to be realized. You know, if you listen to the administration, it's to be realized in a common military project directed against others. And the progressive community is saying, no, wherever there's an against and whenever there's radical otherness, we've lost it. It has to be directed towards a common solution. You know, you asked me a while ago, Anthony, and I never got around to it, talking about the sense of change and transition that we're in right now. I feel very strongly that the ingredients of change are there. They're mulling around. They're not well organized. They're not even very well expressed. That's why I tried to get Denis Kucinich to write a book called The Progressive Vision. And if he doesn't do it, I may have to do it myself.
And we're almost out of time, so if you can...
Yeah. Well, down in San Rafael, there's a couple that's written a book called The Cultural Creatives, and they have argued that there are 50 million people in the U.S. who are looking for progressive change.
Oh, my.
But we just don't know about each other. So a certain amount of reaching out and articulating what we want could precipitate, could galvanize a tremendous change.